Welcome into the Dunked On Basketball podcast, where I have some advice for Clippers fans. If your team is in a game five in a close series, just don't watch. Just don't do it. I mean, we've just had so many miserable game fives for the Clippers going back to 2006, the legendary Daniel Ewing game where Rajah Bell hit the crazy tying three over him, in the overtime for the Suns. Then 2013, Blake gets a high ankle sprain in practice the day before the game. They end up losing to Memphis. Last year, where Chris Paul tries to get a foul from a shooting foul 70 feet from the basket, turns it over, and they end up blowing a big lead late in regulation. And now this game. Danny, aside from the historical misery, what are your takeaways from this game?
Thinking about it a little bit, because we have a little more time passed since the game ended than when we usually record this, what I took away was that this game was the culmination of a couple of the big storylines that you and I have been talking about for the past 3 weeks, and the importance of rest within a game is a big one, the hacking DeAndre Jordan and all the tactics regarding that, and then the importance of bench play. And it was a remarkable game in a lot of ways, and I mean, you could also talk about the officiating and everything, but to me, those angles were such huge factors in the game, and I'm sure we'll hit on all of them.
Yeah, they certainly were, and I thought Pop brought it today. We've been critical of him in the past. He did a much better job with the fouling today. They were quite successful after the fouling. And I think they were a net positive. And one of the reasons he was much better is because he brought in Matt Bonner both to do the fouling so that his main guys didn't get in foul trouble. Although Dia did pick up a couple of cheapies that were somewhat important later on. But then also just Bonner to space the floor. He got two wide open threes in his stint when they were doing it in the first half, made one of them, and then his spacing was really important when they did it again in the second half. And they're able to be successful with that tactic. And they got DJ out of the game in the third, which was important. And that tactic, which we had been a little critical of, worked pretty well. And that was partly facilitated by doing it in a little smarter way than they had before.
Exactly. And one of the things you and I have talked about, and it makes a lot of sense to me, is that if you're going to go to that strategy, that means that you're not really playing defense. So you tilt the way that your lineup works, and ideally...
Yeah, they put Bonner in also. They do it.
Exactly. And the Clippers didn't really counter it in that way. They didn't think about the idea of, oh, we're really not going to be playing offense. I'm not saying necessarily you sit Chris Paul, though Popovich did do the same tactic with Paul out. Because if I were the coach, I wouldn't do hack a DeAndre with Chris Paul out of the game, considering their horrific bench. But the other factor in all this is that it got the result that they wanted, which is not necessarily even the margin changes, but that it got DeAndre Jordan out of the game. And in what became a huge factor later on in the game, and I harped on this on Twitter because it mattered a lot to me, the Clippers actually had J.J. Redick commit a foul to get DeAndre Jordan out of the game in the second quarter.
That was pretty farcical.
J.J. Redick ended up fouling out of this game. And he fouled out, I believe, with a little over a minute to go. And considering what happened, I think you can rest assured that J.J. Redick would have done a better job on the court that last minute than his replacements.
Yeah, I agree with you. It was I don't think I've ever seen that before, where you actually commit a foul and... Yeah, I mean, what was that? That was in the second quarter still,
yes,
right?
Yes, so, second quarter.
I don't recall off the top of my head, but I think the Spurs probably got into the bonus at some point in that quarter and maybe made some free throws, which they might not have had. You know, that costs you a point, too, because you got 1 point of expected value about from a possession. And, you know, if they make two free throws, then it costs you a point. So, yeah, not good on that particular aspect. I think we can kind of do our usual here. Not really going to talk that much about the Dallas-Houston game. I didn't get a chance to watch that. You know, if you have some thoughts later, maybe we can hear them. But let's roll through this game. It started off very well for the Clippers,
yep,
as they were just destroying the Spurs in transition. Blake Griffin with his bust-out dribbles was was really sublime, and Paul was getting out in transition too. I mean, one thing that's so great about Griffin, and Draymond Green will do this too, and a few other guys who are bigs who can grab and go, is that's so tough because a lot of times the other team's bigs won't get back in that situation. They just see the ball ahead of them and they don't run hard. Or even if they do have someone back, you have shooters running the lanes, and then someone like Griffin can get a one-on-one against his man with no help, and he scored a couple buckets like that.
And it also increases the chances of having an odd man rush and having a man advantage, because if that means that you're probably going to have four guys down there, and they might have four, but there's a very good chance they'll have three, and if that person can make a good judgment with the ball, they're probably going to generate an open look somewhere on the floor.
And another nice little strategic wrinkle in that first half, the Spurs had been having a little success stopping one of the Clippers' pet plays, which is the snug pick and roll pretty close to the basket with Paul and Griffin. They brought Aaron Baines in. He came over to the near side block, and what the Clippers were able to do was Paul was able to get middle, and then they had Big Baby duck right in and get a layup. I'm pretty sure that's an adjustment that they worked on for when the Spurs brought someone all the way over across the lane to kind of foil that pick and roll.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of a seven-game series, is you see counters, and then you see counters to those counters.
So now we get to the part where the Clippers lost this game. The end of the first quarter, Chris Paul went out with 125 remaining, and the Spurs outscored them 7-0, and I think 13-2 overall. I know they outscored them by 11 when Paul was on the bench, and the way they did that was in large part with a zone defense that Pop broke out, I would say ingeniously, because you go with that, A, when your floor general is off the floor, Paul, to get them into any kind of a zone offense. They also had Big Baby and DJ on the floor together, zero spacing. So in that case, your center, and one of the big problems with playing zone in the NBA, especially at 2-3, is that your center can't just camp out in the lane like he can in FIBA or in college, but when you had Big Baby and DeAndre Jordan both out there, they're both going to be around the lane anyway. It's much easier for that guy to stay in and kind of muck things up. And during the period when they were playing that zone, they got a couple of offensive rebounds, but they really only got two decent initial shots, one of which was a Big Baby layup that Manu Ginobili blocked. So the Clippers could not really score against that zone defense. It was an adjustment that Pop made, and kind of won them the game.
Considering how well Chris Paul and Blake Griffin play together, would you still consider staggering their minutes to avoid that kind of a problem?
Well, Griffin played for part of that time. It was really only, at the beginning of that second quarter when Paul and Griffin were both out, and that kind of continued the carnage. They lost another 4 points during that period, but I would try to get Paul and Griffin both, either one of them on the court at all times, unless it's a blowout or something. Doc would periodically try and steal some minutes with neither of them out there. But, yeah, I think I would do that. But, I think it was a good strategy. What I might have done if I were Doc was go to Spencer Hawes instead of Big Baby, get some more shooting on the floor against that zone. And Big Baby also struggled pretty badly, I thought, defensively in this game. He had some nice energy plays, especially in the second half, but overall he was not very good defensively with his help defense, and that was a problem for the Clippers as well, especially in that first stint where they got killed.
And another thing to note about what happened with it is that it wasn't like it was the Spurs A team versus the Clippers B team. It was a lot of the Spurs backups versus a lot of the Clippers backups, which is hugely important in the scope of things.
Another nice thing about the zone was they were able to steal some minutes for Aaron Baines with Splitter looking a lot more limited. That was an issue for them, and Baines had not played well in game one, and then he'd been injured / kind of just out of the rotation. Not sure how much of that was each of those two factors for the next few games, but they're able to steal some minutes for him in that zone. Another thing was Austin Rivers regressed in a big way. He won his battle with Patty Mills in game four. Mills smoked him in that period where they got outscored. pretty badly. They ran a nice elevator doors for Mills to start the second quarter, which Big Baby didn't get out to help on at all. That's something you got a very basic NBA play you got to be ready for. And with Baines and Diaw setting the screen, you can help off them. Nobody did. Rivers got trapped in the elevator. He may still actually be hitting that call button and asking for someone to get him out of there. So that was pretty ugly. And the Spurs, again, that was the critical point of the game. You can point to everything else, but that was 11 points that the Spurs got and got right back in the game and took the lead.
And there were some other small points, too, in that second quarter. There were two different three-second violations, which really struck me, that you're sitting there and you don't see that very often in a game, and especially in a game of this importance, to see that, and that just burns you as well.
Yeah, so outside of that stretch, I think a lot of Clippers fans will lament some of the calls, they'll lament the goaltending, they'll feel like some unjust things happen. You can point to a number of plays down the stretch, which we'll get to, but why don't you point to a shot clock violation in the second quarter because they took too long to get into their snug pick and roll set? How about the 2 3-second calls you alluded to because Matt Barnes didn't take a jumper and DJ was stuck down there? How about all the times that they didn't get back on transition defense? Those are all things that really, and we'll get to a few more of them. How about Blake Griffin's lazy front on Tim Duncan, and giving up an easy layup with no weak side help? Let's talk about that kind of stuff, as all of those are plays where they lost a point, they lost 2 points. That to me matters a lot more than what the ref called down the stretch. And the Clippers really got outplayed, I think, from a mental standpoint in this game. The Clippers were able to score, but most of the time it was through superior one-on-one efforts. And when the Spurs scored, a lot of times it was due to inadequate effort or inadequate communication or mental mistakes from the Clippers.
I agree completely. And one of the things that's weird about this game is how well Blake Griffin played in the first quarter might end up being lost in the shuffle considering what happened later on in the game. But I do want to emphasize how well he played and how key he was in their success early on.
Yeah, I mean, Blake, getting to him a little bit, he was really bad defensively pretty much all game. He had a couple of nice plays, but he was responsible for giving up those 2 threes in a row to Bonner, one of which was wide open. And
that's right.
During the hack of DJ stint in the second, he got posted up pretty deep repeatedly. They tried to play him at center at one point, and he was definitely not up to the task there. Generally just did not get out on shooters that well, didn't have a ton of energy defensively, and I don't know whether that was being out of shape, I shouldn't say out of shape, but being tired, or whether it was the fact that he took that hard fall and was having his knee worked on, whether it was, as you said, not getting enough rest, which we can talk more about at your leisure.
Well, I think as we're starting to move into the second half, I didn't really start to notice it until the fourth quarter, but whether it was injury, whether it was fatigue, whatever it was, Blake Griffin, particularly in the fourth quarter, he looked tired. He looked out of sorts, I guess is the better way to put it.
Is a good way to put it.
Yeah, and that was a major factor in how this game resolved because there were numerous plays offensively that I expected him to complete, and then there were some bad defensive ones as well.
Now, I would take a little bit of issue with the idea that he was tired or should be tired because keep in mind, this game went on forever.
Yep.
Even if you're in the game while they're doing the hacka, you shouldn't be getting tired during that period. You've got 20 seconds of defense, and then you got a full minute to recover. So I actually was thinking at the time that they should have not taken those guys out for their normal rest because they basically got it already while you're doing the hacka. They ended up taking them out, and the Clippers bench actually did okay in that second stint, mostly due to luck. The Spurs missed some layups and they hit some crazy shots, including that Rivers bank three at the end of the quarter. But, maybe they could have extended the lead even more, if they had left their starters in. I don't know, but maybe they did in fact get tired either way, but another 2 minutes of rest wasn't going to help them. They rested half the third quarter with the fouling.
Another huge thing with that was the storyline, and we'll talk about it later in this game, but I thought about it in terms of the Haka sections as well, is that we've talked about how when you're on the Spurs side, you want to have offensive players in because you're not playing defense. At the same point, you want to have defensive players in if you're the Clippers because you're not really going to be playing offense. The problem for the Clippers is, unless they had the faith to play Ekpe Udoh, which I would argue in this circumstance they could have, but they didn't, that they don't really have a substantial defensive upgrade to Blake Griffin on roster, because you're thinking that you could use that as an opportunity just because you're not getting his benefit. Blake Griffin is a much better offensive player than defensive player, but when the replacement is Big Baby Davis, who had his own defensive problems in this game, it's a structural issue with this team, and it's the same issue on the perimeter, that you can't upgrade really at the most of the perimeter spots from the starting lineup, so that means you have to keep them out there even though they're not playing offense.
A couple things, more things that we should note. The Spurs hit some pretty crazy jumpers in this game.
Yep.
Dia had two late in the clock. Danny Green had two off the dribble J's late in the clock that went in. Duncan had one late in the clock. Now, part of that, I would argue, was the Clippers, where they just, on that Dia fadeaway, right? Like, you'd say, you don't need to contest that 1 foot fadeaway from 16 feet, but there's one on the shot clock. What else are you doing if you're Blake Griffin? He just sort of deactivated as Dia dribbled out. There's no reason not to at least stay with him and contest that. And that while it was a crazy shot, there was no contest. DJ, same thing. One second left in the shot clock. Duncan gets it at the elbow. You got to be up on him. And he wasn't. And Duncan just was able to shoot that shot with a pretty light contest. So those were some instances where the Clippers just weren't quite there defensively. Just little tiny things that matter. Tim Duncan getting the ball just 2 feet closer to the basket. DJ not quite able to body up on him. Tim Duncan, I think, got, 2-3 buckets on post-ups against DJ, and that's because DJ doesn't quite use his body well enough. A lot of people don't understand that post-defense is much more about using your body to kind of subtly and legally knock the opposing player off balance much more than it is jumping and trying to contest the shot at the top. And DJ hasn't quite mastered that. And it's especially important to push the guy out a little bit more as you're knocking him off balance. So that was another thing.
And for people who want to appreciate that difference, a guy to watch is Andrew Bogut. Bogut doesn't have the athleticism that he had even early in his career, but you can see the way that he can disrupt an offensive player in that space to make what they do harder. And at the bare minimum, that's what a guy with DeAndre's physical gift should be doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's why Kendrick Perkins and on their own team, Big Baby, are so good at post-defense. They are able to use their body, and they kind of just a subtle little bump with your chest, and you're able to knock the guy off balance a little bit. So I think, why don't we try to get into here the fourth quarter. Actually, I mean, why don't we start with the third quarter? Blake killed them in the first half. I think he had 19 points in the first half. And another Popovich adjustment, which I was very surprised by, he went with Duncan on Griffin. And Duncan shut him down pretty darn good. Griffin has had trouble scoring against centers traditionally because he can't kind of use his whole bull-to-the-basket thing. Griffin was not able to make Duncan pay with the jump shot, perhaps hurt by the fact that he was knocked onto that bad elbow in the third quarter. But, usually the Spurs never want to have Duncan go so far away from the basket, and he shut down Griffin pretty darn well in the second half.
I agree with you that Griffin on centers is the type of thing that's given him trouble for the bullying logic, and it's always surprised me, considering the way that the Warriors have sometimes defended Griffin with Bogut, that Popovich has been so reticent to do it. But it worked really well in this game, in the second half at least.
Yeah, another Popovich adjustment was he went to a lineup that we didn't think that he was going to use with Kawhi at the four. And I'm not sure who did this first. When they took out DJ in the third quarter, they brought in Crawford for him. And I'm not sure whether Pop went with Kawhi to match up or vice versa. I think it was Doc who went there first, and he rolled with Griffin at center. That didn't really work too well defensively. You know, they were able to still keep Duncan. And then actually later on, they went with Big Baby and Griffin, and Pop was able to go with Kawhi guarding Big Baby and Duncan on Griffin, and that was a nice matchup for the Spurs as well for a limited amount of time. So we saw Pop make the adjustments that we wanted to see. You know, he of course would say it's not about the adjustment, it's about playing harder, blah, blah. Well, you know, that zone and some of those matchups really work for him tonight, regardless of whether he chooses to poo-poo it or not.
And then, as we talked about earlier, I harped on the Redick foul. The fourth quarter started with Redick getting his fifth. And
let me finish up with one other point.
Oh, sure, sorry.
Again, you know, more of the kind of Clippers mental errors. Chris Paul, at one point tried to drive in semi-transition against Danny Green, I think. Green sat on his right hand really well. Chris kind of flopped into him, tried to draw a foul, did not get the call, and then just gave a frustration foul on, I forget who it was under the basket, who'd just gotten the rebound. That got the Clippers in the bonus. The Clippers then proceeded to commit three shooting fouls, or out on the floor in what would have been non-shooting situations, but then they were in the bonus, gave away points that way. You know, then of course there was the technical too, where Paul just threw the ball at the ref for no reason, really, after he himself had failed to box out Leonard. He was there and he just didn't turn around and get his butt into him, kind of tried to hold him, and Leonard was able to score. And then Paul, you know, there's no reason to throw the ball to the ref there, especially not hard. You should just take the ball out of bounds. And I thought, you know, it wasn't an unjustified technical.
Yeah, I definitely think that the specter on that tech as being a mistake was definitely overblown. I mean, it's always hard for me with techs because you don't know what was said, but I didn't see it as this sort of affront to decency that some other people appeared to.
Yeah, because I wasn't on Twitter during the game with people saying, like, that's just a ridiculous technical foul call.
Yeah, there was a lot of that conversation, like, oh, he just threw the ball to the ref. And it's like, and as we talked about with the Westbrook one against the Pacers, there are so many other things that we can't tell as a part of it. And, I mean, it was unnecessary in that sense. And so I it's hard for me to ever criticize a call like that unless I know the full context. And without it, I'm just going to say there's a decent chance it was justified.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you can say the ref should let it go, but Paul definitely did something that was, like, kind of a jackass move. You know, I mean, there's no reason to throw the ball at the ref there, especially not hard. Why take the risk? No reason to do that. Just take the ball out of bounds. Complain about the call while you're taking the ball out of bounds.
Yeah, express your frustration another way.
I don't know what he was complaining about either on that play. I mean, he was there. He could have boxed out Leonard. He just didn't do it. I don't know if he was mad at himself. Maybe he should have been. You know, maybe it was cognitive dissonance. Who knows, really? But that was obviously a bad play, and it cost them. They lost. They would have been tied down the end if it had not been for that.
Yeah. Ready to move on to me complaining about J.J. Redick's fouls again?
Yes, please.
So Redick, as I said, he picked up that extra foul, and I would have been watching it the whole time after that, because you have that instinct every once in a while of this is going to matter. And then really early on in the fourth quarter, he got his fifth, and so I was sitting there the entire rest of the time going, okay, he's going to get his sixth at an inopportune moment, and it was just waiting for when it would be. It ended up being substantially later than I thought it would be. But there was a lot of other drama in the fourth quarter before and after that, and we talked about it a little bit before, but one of the early things with the fourth quarter was just how many makeable shots Blake Griffin was missing. And that's why, yeah, I said it was out of sorts. It felt weird. You know, you kept things sitting there, and it was, for me, just being somebody watching the game without a dog in the fight, much less being somebody on the floor, it had a cumulative effect. You're just saying, like, this can't happen again. And it kept on happening.
Yeah, I mean, there was that one sequence, especially where, you know, he had one, just went down around and out, tip in, same thing. And, you know, certainly he could have made some shots. He'll tell you that he should have made those shots. But also, a lot of people miss, quote-unquote, makeable shots when Tim Duncan is around.
Yeah, they do. And sadly, Tim Duncan made some of those, or missed some of those in the 2013 playoffs, too.
So, picking it up with maybe about 4 minutes left, the Clips finally started really going to that double high pick and roll. I think that they were saving that in large part for the end of the game. Because I didn't see them run that often before that. Did you?
I noticed it a couple of times, but I didn't notice it as regularly as in game four and in game, I think it was game three as well.
Yeah. So, and they had success with that. Paul had a couple of nice sweet moves. You might say they should have gone to that play more since the Spurs had so much trouble stopping it. And the Spurs didn't really break out anything new strategically on that play. It was basically just trying to switch it. And they're able to still get pretty good looks out of it. Paul got a couple of buckets, and then Blake was able to get a nice attempt at a layup with about 40 seconds left, or I think maybe a little more than that, where he might have gotten fouled by Green. But yeah, I mean, it was the Spurs started hitting some crazy shots. They were able to take a lead of, I think, 7 points, and then it was desperation time trying to come back for the Clippers, and they weren't ever quite able to get over the hump.
And one of those tactical decisions was that until very late, I think it was about a minute and a half left, Doc Rivers had Crawford in for an extended period. It was Crawford, Redick, Paul, and then, you know, basically the starters in Crawford. And there were a couple times that Jamal just got worked on defense, and I think there was one with Kawhi in particular.
Yeah, I mean, there was, he did give up some pretty bad plays. I mean, in the fourth quarter, he gave up 2 threes. One was to Green, where he and Redick basically collided with each other. One was guarding Mills and one was guarding Green, and they basically just switched positions while the ball was in the corner. Instead of those two guys switching, they miscommunicated, and Danny Green got a wide open left wing three, because Crawford just ran into Redick. It was about as ugly a communication as you'll see there. And then there was another time when Kawhi had the ball on the left elbow, and Crawford reached in, and Kawhi was able to get a shooting foul there. So, yeah, Crawford probably took a little bit more off the table defensively than he provided offensively in that stint. He wasn't able to make that three that could have tied it when Barnes got the rebound and hit two free throws in the final minute. Also, in another very key play, the Clippers got a steal, and DeAndre Jordan was about at the three-point arc. The steal happened pretty close to the basket, and Jordan just didn't run down at all. It was Crawford with the ball. Duncan was back. Crawford went in, missed the layup on Duncan, got caught in the cameras, and then the Spurs came back down. Blake Griffin, not a ton of activity. It was a 5-on-4, but he basically was kind of just standing there. They threw it to Dia in the corner. He hit a three, and that's actually how they went up 7.
Yep.
That was a huge 5-point swing. That layup could have cut it to 2. If DJ and Blake cross half court and run, if DJ sprints down, that's a tip dunk instead of Tim Duncan getting the rebound on that play. So, you know, again, maybe they were tired. Maybe they weren't quite into it mentally, but just another small play where the effort wasn't quite made, and that's, unless the Clippers can win game 6, something they could think about all offseason, those type of little plays.
And when you think about the trade-off of running down court versus going back, then the hope is that you're going to then be in a better position to stop the play. And there was no one within a mile of Boris Diaw when he made that shot. And you can talk about how it was an odd man rush, but there was no one near him. They didn't force anybody to make a hard decision. They said, okay, we're going to concede that shot. And bang, he made it.
Yeah, I mean, Griffin was kind of caught between Bellinelli on the wing and Dia in the corner there. I mean, you probably want to give Dia the shot, who had not really been hitting before then. But still, I mean, once Dia got the ball, he made no move at all to try and get to him. He just
stood there,
hands on his knees, looking pretty exhausted.
So now are we going to get into the real last stretch of it?
Yeah, I think so. It started off really. Let's see, where am I?
I would start the real end stretch with Redick fouling out.
Yeah, I mean, what do you think of that call?
I thought it was a bad call. I thought it was one of those. there are a lot of these that happen in the NBA, especially right now, is where it was a lot worse when you got to see replays. Like, when I first saw it,
Didn't look like a foul to me live, yeah, but, you know,
but it looked worse. It looked worse to me later, but it was still, I wouldn't have called it, you know, it was one of those. And that took Redick out of the game, fair or not, but when you play as long as he did with five fouls, and I give JJ a lot of credit for that, especially because they weren't giving him easy defensive assignments, Rose, that because he was playing with Jamal. And he did that, and you're opening yourself up to that or getting called for an offensive foul or something like that. And so they lost him, and as we've talked about with the Clippers, Doc the GM hurt Doc the coach because he just didn't have the right replacements in as even options for him.
Yeah, no, I mean, they had to play Austin Rivers down the stretch, or they had to go with Barnes, who is someone you don't necessarily really need to guard. Barnes, again, just could not get it going. He's been pretty awful with his outside shot. Missed a couple, wasn't even really able to space the floor very well. So not a great game for him. But then, you know, they ran a look where it started off like a double high pick and roll in Horns, and then they reversed it over to Crawford. They ran a little side pick and roll action. Blake got right on in. Looked like he would probably tell you that he should have had the and one on that play. It was a foul on Kawhi. But then Blake ended up missing both free throws. Jordan, amazing effort on the offensive glass, keeps it alive. Crawford misses a three pretty open that could have tied it, way short. And then Barnes got the rebound hit too, and then you're at 108-107.
Yeah, and then you get Austin Rivers' defensive replacement. And
that's right. Yeah, they put after that timeout, right?
Yeah, I snarked pretty hard on Twitter because Austin Rivers is a defensive replacement seems incomprehensible to me. But when the other option is Jamal Crawford, I mean, I'm not saying I would have put in Dante Jones, even a ice cold Dante Jones, because Austin Rivers he's not a good defensive player. And what we saw in that play was a horrible, horrible Austin Rivers defensive play that didn't end up biting them because Danny Green missed the wide open three.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't so awful. I mean, at least he helped enough to do something to stop Kawhi, who was isolating on the left elbow. But Green did a nice replacement, moved down a little bit onto the wing. Rivers totally lost him, reached in on Kawhi, and Green got as wide open of a three as you'll ever see. But, you know, was way short on it, which was quite lucky at the time for the Clippers.
See, I think you're a little bit more forgiving, and I'm not saying this to be critical of,
I mean,
of Austin, because I don't know. I don't think that he did a lot to stop Kawhi. I think Kawhi's just like, hey, look at that, Danny Green's wide open. You know, I don't think it was a situation where he stopped it. It was that it created a better option.
So then the Clippers were able to get the rebound. 6.9 seconds left, I think. Advance the ball using their last timeout, which became critical as well, or would have if they could have gotten a defensive rebound at the very end.
Spoiler alert.
So the play started with Chris Paul down by the baseline. They put Kawhi on him thinking that the play was going to be for him. Paul cuts up towards the top of the key, gets a screen from DeAndre Jordan, gets held a little bit, and on the most important play of the game, Chris Paul decided that it was more important to flop and fall down to try and get a call, which was no one's ever going to call that. It was just as bad as his attempt to shoot from 70 feet away and get a shooting foul in the Oklahoma City game. So he ends up falling down, just, you know, basically tripping him intentionally himself to try to get the call. Doesn't get open, and that leaves Diaw was denying the inbounds, and that left Crawford to have to throw a very difficult pass to Blake, but an awesome pass over the outstretched arms of Dia. Blake caught the ball on the move, but there again was Tim Duncan. I don't know why Pop decided on that play to go with Dia back on Griffin after Duncan had successfully guarded him for most of the game. I think he maybe rightly considered that they weren't going to go to an ISO for Blake in that situation, and Duncan would be better at the rim. And as it turned out, that was correct. Duncan challenged the shot and forced a miss by Blake.
Were you thinking at all about the possibility of an alley-oop there? I thought of it for a second, but then I thought that would have been such a gutsy call. I mean, I think it would. He was open for it had Blake made that decision, but I totally understood why he took the shot.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a weird play, and you're in that situation sometimes, especially when the ball hangs up in the air, and it's coming from a direction outside of the basket. When you catch it there, you don't know quite where you were. I think Blake might have thought he was a little closer than he was because he was on 1 foot. Normally, you would kind of catch there and try and power up off of 2 feet. I think, you know, that's what you might have wanted to try, but I don't think he knew exactly where he was. He went for the shot a little further out maybe than he wanted to. Duncan was there and disrupted him, so I don't know if he ever really saw DJ. And then, of course, DJ offensive goaltended. Pretty obvious call, although one thing that was not called was Parker just yanked. He yanked on the back of his jersey pretty much as he was doing the tip-in, maybe a little bit afterwards, but definitely committed a foul. You know, maybe the goaltending violation occurred first, but very close. I'd be interested to see what the referee report has to say about that one tomorrow.
I didn't even see the Tony Parker play. I'll openly admit to that. I didn't see it at all.
Yeah,
but I didn't have the benefit of rewinding it.
Yeah, it was on like my 8th rewatching of the play. It was, you know, as I was just scrolling it back and forth that I saw it. So I doubt anyone else was talking about it either, but it definitely happened. I mean, he grabbed his jersey and pulled him back. You see him kind of, you know, get pulled back right after the tip-in occurs.
So now we get to the Danny Green free throws. And well, so actually,
let's go to the inbound first, right?
That's true.
You know, you're trying to deny the ball inbounds, and this may not have been a critical play because the Spurs had a timeout left that they could have taken. But the Spurs did a pretty darn nice, or I'm sorry, the Clippers did a really nice job of denying the ball. There was some fighting between Ginobili and Barnes. Parker sets the screen for Barnes. Again, just as egregious and dumb of a flop as Paul had. I mean, trying to get away from the play foul, he just falls down, lets Barnes run right through him. Not going to get that call, and instead gives up the chance to get Manu open. Barnes denied him successfully, and Griffin denied Green successfully for a time as well. There wasn't even really a screen for Green. I think what was supposed to happen was Parker was then supposed to screen for Green after he screened for Manu, but Parker, you know, let himself get knocked over. The screen wasn't there. Griffin, I think, looked back to see whether the ball had been inbounded and then could not stay with Green as he accelerated in the corner and they inbounded it and he was able to make the catch.
And then so he makes the catch and he gets two. And so they're down. They're up one. Sorry. They're up one. Makes the first. And for, I think you, since you had the benefit of rewatching it, I'm guessing you watched it plenty of times. Do you want to explain what happened on the second free throw?
Well, so it's very interesting, and I'm not entirely sure. Obviously, Danny Green got the rebound. I'm not entirely sure whose job it was to box out Green. Normally, you would have the guy in the top lane line do that. But some coaches sometimes will have those two guys pinch down the bottom guy and the top guy. Rivers didn't really do either of those things. He kind of just floated out, hoping to get an outlet. But the way Paul ran in, it looked like he may have been the one who was supposed to be responsible for boxing out Green and also maybe so he could get in position for an outlet. But Green realized that the shot was going to be short, came very, very close to stepping over the line before the ball hit the rim. It was, I don't think he did, but it was extremely close. I'll be interested to see what the report says on that one too. They'll probably have one of those little asterisks next to it as, you know, not something that could be seen without the aid of replay. So Paul is almost there, and then Green suddenly accelerates, prevents the box out. Paul tries to grab his arm, doesn't work. And then the Clippers still would have been fine, but they got totally unlucky. Barnes was right there for the board. He went right for it, and it hit that foam part on the bottom of the backboard that's there to protect your head, bounced out, and that's why Green was able to get the rebound, because of that unlucky bounce off the foam. I mean, Barnes would have been there, but he saw where the ball was going. He tried to get right where it was going to land, and if it hits 2 inches higher on the board and doesn't hit the foam, Barnes has the rebound. But it didn't happen that way. Green got it, and that was the game.
Yeah, it was definitely a crazy game. Any other takeaways beyond that?
Or it's 42 minutes on, or whatever this is, on one game is not enough for you.
Hey, I wanted to open it up. You know, there's always more room for more insight. I mean, we talked for that Warriors comeback. We talked about it longer than it took to actually air, so we can do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you make a good point. You know, if you think we spent too much time on this game, listeners, please let us know on Twitter. But, you know, I think this was such an epic game, it needed to be talked about in great detail. I guess now the question is, going forward, are you giving the Clippers any chance, game six on San Antonio's home floor?
Absolutely. I think that they didn't play they played a great game for small stretches, but they didn't play a great game, and they've proven that they can do it. I mean, it's going to be hard, and it's a huge mental adjustment. That's something else we saw from the Warriors-Pelican series, is that coming back from a really tough loss, especially in this case when you have to do it on the road, is a huge challenge, but I'm not counting the Clippers out at all. And
yeah, they got some great players. I mean, and you know, I think in close games now, they've kind of, you know, I wouldn't say they blew this game necessarily, you know, as abjectly as they did the game two loss, because, you know, they didn't have a lead, but certainly with a lot of the mental mistakes, I think you can say that they did. And, you know, sadly, a pattern for them going back to that game five against Oklahoma City last year. But, you know, they have good enough guys that they could win this next game by 10 points on the road. You know, I mean, they have that type of talent on this team.
The way that I'd phrase it is that the Clippers have had a chance to win 4 out of the 5 games in this series.
Sure.
And anytime you've done that, then you have a chance without some sort of catastrophic injury. And that's the other thing beyond the other game that we should talk about, is the change in the Kevin Love expectations. But when you do that, then you have a reasonable chance. I mean, it's definitely not going to be easy, but when you're facing the defending champs, it's not going to be that way. But I think we should move on to the other game. It is getting a little bit of the short strip, but I mean, to me, the Rockets-Mavericks game was more about the better team, the team that still had the horses, just winning the game. And
yeah, I kind of assumed that's what was going to happen, and that's why, you know, I had some other things going on tonight, but well, I figured it would be okay to record without having watched it, especially since you did.
Yeah, Al Frucamino played pretty well. I have to give him a little bit of credit. He tried hard on defense, and he was given a lot to do, and they started him, which is something that I wanted them to do. But the other thing for me with Dallas is I feel like Dirk, especially defensively, is getting close to his last legs. And that's sad, but, you know, it happens. And he could prove me wrong, maybe getting a summer off, maybe getting a summer of people saying that he's done or close to done will motivate him to put in the work to have another great season. I'm never going to count him out. But watching this game, I started thinking about what players on this team do you really want to build around, even in the short term? Like, who is the core of this team? And that is terrifying, because if the core of your team is basically Chandler Parsons coming off microfracture, that's a problem.
Yeah, and Dirk, I mean, and now does Dirk, they've already kind of struck out a few times on their big free agent targets in these last few years. You know, Dirk, granted, it took less. They got Parsons, that obviously did not pay off for them in the playoffs, but now it's going to be come play with Dirk, who, you know, can't really defend anymore. You know, what's your pitch going to be if you're the Mavericks, other than, you know, you got some awesome locker rooms and what's a pretty first-class organization? I think they may be getting to the point pretty quickly here where they're just going to have to accept the rebuild, especially if, you know, they can't reload this summer. And certainly in the summer of 2016, make sure that they have plenty of cap room and flexibility that year. But I'm not sure that they're really that prime of a destination when everyone else has the space too.
Yeah, they need to do something similar to, I wrote a piece about the Lakers a couple days ago, and it's that you need to be open to the big positive, but if you don't get that, you can't rush into something because you want to be better in the short term. And similarly, the guy that I'm worried about for the Lakers is Rajon Rondo, who will not be with Dallas next year. But Dallas is in a tough spot, because if they have the motivation to try to do something next year in a stacked Western Conference, I think people are underestimating how good the West is going to be next year, then that could hurt their long-term prospects, because they need to be in the circumstance where they're adding assets to make it so that the next big guy wants to go there, because if they're not, I don't think they're going to run there right now. I mean, if you're Marc Gasol, let's say, and Dallas can offer you the same contract that the Spurs can offer, and the Grizzlies, of course, the team he's played on his entire career, I don't know why you take the Dallas offer. It's just not the best one on the table.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you're now going to have to make up for Dirk Nowitzki's defensive shortcomings as well. That's going to be pretty bad. Also, we got to remember now that they traded their first rounder in 2016, top seven protected, to the Celtics. So
yep,
that's another reason. I mean, I don't think they're going to be that bad to be in the top seven next year, but not exactly going to reap the rewards if they do kind of stumble and fall out of the playoff picture. Other news, we got to talk about the fact now that Love has been pretty much declared out for the playoffs. You know, maybe some possibility. It has been termed unlikely that he will return at all during the playoffs. And my reaction today on Twitter was, the Cavs very well might still make it to the finals, but to me, this eliminates just about any possibility that they beat whoever comes out of the West.
Yeah, I'll adapt Kevin Pelton's any chance rule, so I will say that there is a chance, but it is such a monumentally low chance that you don't have to give it much credence, because we know now that the team that comes out of the West is going to be a really good team. You know, it's not going to be one of those circumstances where you get lucky and somebody, you know, somebody stumbles out, and the only way that would happen is with an injury, and LeBron is still a magnificent player, but without Kevin Love, assuming he can't play at all in the playoffs, you don't have the versatility that you're going to need against the Western Conference. But what do you think this does to the Eastern Conference playoff picture?
I still think that I would have them with a greater chance of any other team of making it. I think it certainly makes it harder, but with the way Atlanta has been playing, missing Thabo Sefolosha, Millsap and Horford not quite looking right. Although, you know, I mean, there is an argument that the Hawks have gotten a little bit unlucky in this Nets series. They've been missing a lot of shots they would normally make. They're getting the same mix of shots. You know, Horford and Millsap just not hitting the way they normally would. Same thing with Korver. So maybe, and they also played much better offensively in that last game. They just, you know, the Nets hit a lot of shots that maybe they wouldn't normally. So maybe the Hawks will get it together. They'll win the next two and we'll feel better about them. You know, I think the Bulls, we've discussed their issues with player usage and also just those individual players' performance. You know, I listened to my friend Doug Tonis' podcast on the Bulls today, and he made a good point that just the Bulls' front court, supposedly their strength, just hasn't been playing that well against the Bucks. And yeah, the Bulls' front court is going to need to massively outplay the Cavs if they're going to win.
It's a huge point. The other compartment of that is if Blatt is more willing to play LeBron at the four with actual perimeter players around him, will Thibodeau still play Pau Gasol? Like, will they do the Gasol-Noah? Will they do the concept of strength versus strength? Because I think Cleveland would just abuse that.
Yeah, no, I think you're probably right. The other thing, too, maybe you can concoct a scenario for Cleveland in which Mike Miller gets taken out of mothballs, and you know, he was a pretty effective player just a year ago, and I'm not sure exactly what happened to him this year that made him pretty much totally unplayable. Sean Marion was still a decent player before too. You know, maybe after all the rest that he's had, he can come back and be decent. You know, maybe they can get something out of one of those two guys still, because those are both guys we thought would be big contributors for them at the start of the season, although they've been taken out of the rotation. I don't expect that those guys are going to be any good, but you know, you could construct a scenario in which they plausibly could, I guess, at least.
And what's kind of amazing about this Cleveland team in that sense is that I think a lot of us expected that center was going to be the weak point in terms of them, in terms of depth, but it really is power forward. You could also say it would be point guard if Kyrie got hurt. They would have, you know, they would have issues related to filling that role, but they don't even have a poor man's Kevin Love, unless you're going to count Mike Miller that way. But obviously the rebounding is a huge swing factor, and I think they're going to miss him a lot. As much as I've ripped on them, and other people have too, for underutilizing Love, he still was a heck of a lot better than what their overall rotation is going to look like, because Tristan Thompson's a quality basketball player, but it's more about, in a way, replacing Tristan Thompson than replacing Kevin Love.
Yeah, no, and we touched on that as well yesterday. I mean, I think just the big difference now is that what are they going to do if they get to the finals? That's the biggest issue now for me, because if it's the Warriors, if it's the Spurs, if it's the Clippers, if it's the Rockets, I think any of those teams look better than any of their competition in the East right now. So I find it difficult to believe that they could beat any of those teams without Kevin Love. But any other news items to talk about today? I think we hit on everything.
I don't think we got an update on Mike Conley, but that's the other huge dynamic. But I don't think I've heard anything, so.
Yeah, no, I think they have to wait for the swelling to go down to really make an analysis there. But, you know, we'll see if things could get a little interesting if the Blazers can win tomorrow. I don't expect them to, but without Conley, as you noted yesterday, Lillard has been able to get loose, and that might jumpstart the Blazers' offense.
One other quick thing to get thoughts on. I just saw this on Real GM. It's being reported by Fred Kerber of the New York Post that the Nets are willing to offer Brook Lopez a max deal if he opts out. Would you do that?
Whew. Yeah, you know, maybe I would. I think a lot of it too, just from a business standpoint, would depend about on whether it's insurable or not. I would think that maybe it wouldn't be, but you know, we don't know that at this point. But from a non-business standpoint, the max deal this year, again, is going to be a much smaller percentage of the cap once it goes up from $67 million to what's now a projected $89 million the next year. So if you think about it, his max will be only basically close to three quarters of what it would be had he waited one more year. And then the cap's supposed to go up again. Probably won't go up all the way to the $108 million that it's projected to. The reason that it's projected to go up to 108 is because it's anticipated that the teams won't be able to spend all the way up to the cap in the percentage that they are supposed to, because it's going to go up so much in 2016. So then that would trigger an automatic raise of the salary cap even higher to go all the way up to 108 in 2017. That 108 would not be commensurate with the revenues. It would just be kind of artificial because they didn't get high enough in 2016. However, 2017, one of the two sides is going to opt out, and one would imagine that they would then track the revenues and the salary cap more closely again when they reach a settlement, and that 108 is probably never going to happen. I mean, the way it's projected now is it goes up to 108 and then goes back down to 100. So I would imagine that the 2017 salary cap, depending on what the BRI split is, ends up being more in, like, you know, somewhere between 90 and 100 million rather than all the way up to 108. So that's something important to note about those numbers that have been kind of passed around. If that enormous cap increase again in 2017, probably not going to actually come to fruition.
Yeah, the only thing I would add is that, assuming Deron Williams picks up his player option, which I think we all expect that he will, which is in 2016, 2017.
This just in.
Yeah, this just in. That the combination of Deron and a maxed Brook Lopez would make it prohibitively unlikely that they would get a max caliber guy in 2016, notably Kevin Durant. But you can talk about that is unrealistic enough that you don't really need to think about it, and Deron expires after that year. So whatever the cap is in 2017, unless they throw more bad money at it, and they actually wouldn't have that much time to throw bad money at it, they would have the space to go after somebody in that class, which I actually think is a very underappreciated free agent class, because it's going to have Stephen Curry, Russell Westbrook, Serge Ibaka in it. At least there'll be other guys too.
Well, and of course, if they could get Durant, then they'll just trade away a first-round pick or two to clear off the space in 2016, right?
And it's true that tons of teams will have cap space.
That was sarcasm, by the way.
You were joking, but the seven-year rule will probably give them the ability.
Yeah, no, they actually literally probably could do that if they really needed to. But, you know, they don't have too many draft picks left. But, yeah, they could get into, you know, 2021 or something like that and trade that pick if they really had to, and they really could get Kevin Durant. I'm sure they would do that. But, you know, Brooklyn not really seeming like the most glamorous market that I think maybe people kind of thought it would. There's this somewhat antiseptic feel to the franchise, it seems, and a lot of kind of negative tweets about what the atmosphere is and in their building and stuff like that. So, you know, I'm not quite sure that they are really the prime free agent destination. I think their ratings were among the lowest in the league on a percentage basis of their market this year. So not really an exciting team. Maybe that would change, but I don't really view them as exactly a marquee free agent destination at this point.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you, though that can change with time, and all you really need is a player to say, I really want to live in New York, and the Knicks aren't an option for whatever reason either, because they spent the money on more flotsam, or because, you know, for whatever reason. But all it takes is one, but getting that one will be awfully hard.
Well, with that reference to flotsam, I think we've beaten up today pretty well. Thanks a lot for listening. You can subscribe on iTunes, give us a rating. That's always nice. We appreciate that. And we'll be back again tomorrow night. Thanks, everyone.